Welcome to the GeoMob Podcast, where we discuss geo-innovation in any and all forms, whether for fun or profit.
Welcome to another GeoMob Podcast. This afternoon, my guest is Miguel Garcia Alvarez, who runs the magnificent Mapas Milhaud site and writes the new Cartographer's Tale weekly blog on map matters. Miguel has a background in cartography and geography, which he says goes back nearly 35 years when he was captivated by atlases that his parents had. And in addition to that, he works as a telecommunications engineer, which is not the sort of thing that most geo geeks do, but then we've got people from all over the world coming and doing strange things on the podcast. So welcome, Miguel. And he's been working in telco engineering for the last 16 years. He works for a big American software company. We're not going to mention them. And he also works remotely from his home somewhere in Spain. So, Miguel, welcome to the GMO podcast. My first question for you, apart from saying hi, is tell us a bit more about the atlases and why you got in, how you got into geography when you were young.
Thank you, Stephen. I'm really glad to be here with you today talking. So the way it all worked, at least the way I remember, is that definitely my parents had a few atlases. There was a historical atlas and a political physical atlas, right? And this was probably around the late 80s, early 90s, right? Because I recall that one of the gifts that I had when I turned 9 or 10, probably 10, it was a new atlas that had, all the new European borders after the fall of the Soviet Union and the Iron Curtain and everything, all the new borders and, a lot of fascinating things and, seeing how atlases, borders were changing and also even the denomination of the cities, right? Because in Spanish, we used to had the own versions of most of the cities in Europe. And at that time, we started adopting, the name of the actual, used by the actual country, its own name. I don't recall how to say that. But all that really got me fascinated, right? And that's probably the way I started going to the library, checking a few more atlases, books, seeing, the different types of representing the world that we had, right? It's not just a simple way of painting lines, but also how projections and plenty of other things were working out. I was just fascinated. And since then, I've been kind of linked to that.
Okay. So you know what it was for me? It was stamp collecting. When I was sort of that age, 8-10 years old, I was collecting stamps, and I used to get these big bags of stamps from all over the world. And you'd look at these stamps and then you'd try and find out something about the country. And, in those days we had a big encyclopedia and an atlas. So I'd go from the encyclopedia to the atlas and look at the stamps. And also, like you said, you start to learn the local pronunciation of countries and places rather than the anglicized ones that we grow up with. So, yeah, I get that. So let's go to Mapas Milhaud. Yep, I got that right. I pronounced it right.
You did.
First of all, explain to our listeners what Mapas Milhaud is.
So the way that it was created initially, right, when I started in social media, probably around 2008, 2009, I was writing a few stuff in, a few blogs, like probably everyone at the time, mainly focusing, to be fair, on music, randomly. Then I shifted to some kind of cultural writing. I was writing a bit of history, a bit of geography, a bit of everything, right? But again, I was more, it was at this time probably that I discovered Reddit, I would say. And I found quite a few subreddits that were extremely amazing for map sharing. And, people were I mean, not only sharing new maps or funny maps, but a lot of historical maps. And if you were digging and you were your way around Reddit, you can really get into these fascinating communities that they share really old maps. And, you know, social media at the time, so you start sharing pictures there about some maps that you find interesting. And then you're reading a book and you take a picture and you upload it to Twitter or to Facebook or to whatever. And then at some point, there was a few people that start saying, oh, why didn't you just put them all in one place and everything? So it was at this time that I was a bit tired of maintaining a blog. And, you know, like we all made mistakes. But at the time, I thought that social media was the thing to go, right? So I started, I remember creating a Facebook page where I started uploading a daily map in there, right? And that grew quite a lot. And I was fine with it. And probably fast forward 2022, right? You know, all the social media definitely crumbled down, at least from my point of view, right? We realized that you're not the owner of anything. You're creating content for someone else's benefit, that you don't even agree with that people anymore. So that was the time that I decided, okay, so all the work that I'm doing in social media definitely belongs somewhere else. I started creating Mapasmilord as a catalog, as a map catalog, all in Spanish as of today, that map catalog, where I started, you know, uploading all the maps that I was interested on. With one, so I set some boundaries myself. So all the maps have to, I need to have rights to put the maps on, which I believe everybody should, but you know, nowadays, not that many people care. I always put the author of the map. A link to the site, whatever that is, even if it's an old guy, right? Even if it is a map from the 15th, 16th century, I try to make sure that I know the author and a bit of context, like 2-3 paragraphs, providing a bit of context on what's the map, what was the purpose, who published, I mean, to which audience, and a bit like that, right? And the problem is that I started uploading maps and maps, and I realized quickly that I definitely want to tell longer stories, right? A single map by itself sometimes is not enough. And that's the reason why I started publishing a newsletter in Spanish, which is basically supporting this Mapasmilord.
Okay. So, I mean, I just realized as you started talking about attribution and giving credit to people and everything, it was like you were reciting the guidelines that we use on the Maps in the Wild website. You know, we'll only ever publish something if you give us permission. If you send it to us, we say you've given us permission. But exactly the same thing, you know, that this isn't just find anything you like and publish it and reuse it. You know, just ask. Most people are very happy if you say, can I publish this? They say, oh, yes, please do. So how many maps have you got on Mapasmilord?
As of today, it's a bit over 900.
Okay.
So the thing is that internally, I have at least over 10,000. I just have to, you know, I just don't have the time to do the work. I would love to, but I need a work that pays the bills.
Absolutely.
At the end of the month,
yeah,
right?
I get that. And also, if you're going to write even a few, two or three paragraphs, that means every post takes you half an hour or an hour. So it's a big undertaking. And you've categorized them so that you can search them using different categories. And a lot of them are very old maps, aren't they, that are in the public domain. But it's a great resource for just finding old maps.
Yeah, and that's the thing, that there's so many good resources today. So if you go back 15 years ago when most of the libraries haven't digitalized anything, but, you know, David Ramsey started with all his catalog, putting that online, and then right after, like, big libraries, like in France, you have Gallica, also the Library of Congress in the US, but plenty of the local libraries also keep on uploading amazing maps. And the problem is that, yeah, they value equally any single map that they have, right? So trying to dig in and fish for the right ones and you know, serving that to the public, I find that really exciting. I like it.
So Does Mappas Milhaud make you money?
Not really today, not much. So the way that I've done it is I enable some level of subscription through Substack on the Spanish version, at least just to get to the point that it doesn't cost me money. But I don't think it will ever give me that money to stop working, unlikely. I would love to, but no.
No, these projects are a labor of love, and if you can just not have to invest too much of your own money in them,
exactly,
then I think that's the best you can hope for. Certainly, with Maps in the Wild, even after 6 years, we still haven't, we still just accept that we're going to pay, it's not a fortune, it's hundreds of dollars a year, a few hundred dollars a year to keep the thing going. And we sort of think that's worth it. And I guess you must do too. Yeah. So then you started writing your newsletter in Spanish. And what I wanted to just, more recently, I think the end of last year, was it, you started writing in English?
Beginning of this one,
right. So there's a link in the show notes, everyone who's listening, to The Cartographer's Tale. It's difficult for me to say how much I love these posts, Miguel. I mean, I look forward to them. They land in my inbox and I'm excited immediately because they're quite deep. They're thoughtful. I thought I knew loads of this stuff. You know, I thought I knew about old maps and projections and time zones and all this stuff, you know. And actually, I'm learning massive amounts from you every week. And I want to say thank you. But the first question is, are these the Spanish posts that you're now translating into English, or are they new thoughts?
So most of them, as of today, they're translations from Spanish, not direct translations. I always want to say that they're adaptations.
Right.
Mainly because there's always certain cultural references when I speak. Definitely when I write in Spanish, you have to keep certain level of cultural references. And I need to adapt to the best of my knowledge to something that can be consumed by, an English-speaking audience, which is slightly different. So there's some examples that have changed and some things that have to be moved around. But as of today, it's true that most of it is adaptations of things that I'm writing in the Spanish side. So the goal is to basically have a combination, right? I probably will always reuse, but start also publishing some of the new stuff directly in English first, even if I have to adapt it later in Spanish.
Right, okay. Well, you said to me that you didn't talk, apart from work-wise, you hadn't done much conference speaking or anything in English. I can absolutely tell you that your writing is first class in English. It may not be first language, but it's very close.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
So start out, give our listeners a sort of general sense of what The Cartographer's Tale is about. What's the theme behind the posts?
So generally, the way that I see it, as I was mentioning before, right? Like I've always liked telling stories, and there's times that you get to certain maps that really have a story to tell, and I would love to just do it, you know, in the catalog, but it doesn't feel right, because the catalog needs to be to certain level concise, and therefore I started. And initially, when I started the newsletter in Spanish, right, I thought about publishing, you know, like a bunch of unrelated maps and stuff like that. But soon you realize that, I believe it was in Spanish that I was talking about cartography for blind people, which is something that I definitely had to adapt to the English version. But that requires a lot of work because that changes dramatically from language to language, the way that blind people read and have evolved, right? But when I was writing that, I realized that it requires context, right? You come up with a map, but a map by itself, it doesn't provide how you got there, right? How you got to the point that there's certain places that you have to teach people that are blind, right? And that forced me to create the background story. And I do like creating narratives in the sense of you need to establish the overall context from beginning to end and make sure that it's not just that tiny bit of knowledge that you get, but also that you have all the tools and elements that allows you to understand the wider thing, and also that allows you to search for tangential areas that might be of your interest. And that's mainly how I came with that, right? And then at that point, I realized that I could actually tell almost any story through maps, because that's the beauty of it, right? It doesn't really matter what you talk about. Sometimes it might not be that it's cartographic centric or geographically centric. It might be just history, or it might be just something, you know, like actual nowadays. But it maps that provide, because they're so wide, right? It's not just that you have the historical maps, but it's also that they provide a perspective or an intention. You have a huge amount of propaganda maps. You have a huge amount of data maps today, right? Like data visualization through maps is amazing in the 21st century, and there's people doing brilliant work, and you can leverage all that experience in order to tell certain stories or certain perspectives in there.
I so agree with you about telling stories, you know, and I mean, and that's what you do in the blog, in these posts every week. And I just thought, I mean, recently you published three posts about time, and on a superficial level, there's almost nothing to do with maps in those posts. It's all about how time evolved and our understanding of time. But actually, you know, when you dig in there, of course, there's a lot of geography associated with time, particularly when you're talking about time in different countries and all of that. And I just thought maybe we could talk a little bit about those three posts, because they were fantastic. And I've linked to them in the show notes, because I think they're, anybody who hasn't seen your posts on the Cartographer's Dale should start by going and looking at these three posts sometime, because it's a long story that evolves over 3 weeks.
Yeah, so the way that came to be, I was sitting one day and I, you know, it was early March, and here in Europe we changed the time zone. You know, the daylight saving gets in at the last weekend of March. And I thought, I really want to talk about that this year, right? Like all the history behind and everything. But then I start writing, and then you realize, but it's a bit, you know, it requires some more background, in the sense like, how do you, can you explain daylight saving if you don't have a really concept of time zones, right? And that's how it came, like the second. So the daylight saving is the third one. And then I had to write the second one, which is time zones, right? And with time zones, you start explaining the overall thing with time zones. But again, like, in order to have time zones, you also require some level of definition of time by itself. Like, why are we even there to measure time in the first place, right? And that's the reason why I took one step back, one more, right? And I write the first version on the 24 hours. To be fair, I did wrote an article for a university here in Spain, in the Basque Country, like 10, 15 years ago, that it was basically about that, about how we divided the day into 24 hours, and, you know, all the history behind and all the reasoning behind, which is quite interesting, solid. Not necessarily, it could have been other ways, probably, but it was the way it was, and there was a good reasoning behind, and how determining that is, right? Because the way that we had 24 hours is determining that we have 24 time zones, and in a way that determines that the way that we put the meridians and everything, they're separated 15 degrees from each other. So it's just like this tiny thing that came up within Mesopotamia in the Middle East like 5,000 years ago, it affected so much in the way that we behave today, or we measure time today, right?
And also the fact that we didn't always have 24 hours in a day.
Yep.
You know, I mean, we used to just divide sunrise to sunset into an equal number of... So an hour wasn't the same length in the summer as it was in the winter.
Exactly. But this is the typical thing that it happened to me, and I believe it should happen to almost anyone. When you think about sundials, right? Sundials are definitely finite. They have an amount of divisions, and they work through the day. But the days are not equal in length across the year. But the divisions are going to still be the same in the sundial. So if you, until I read it, thought about it before. But you have it there, and it's, yeah, definitely, that's only one way of measuring the hours of the day itself, like the daylight is just by the sundial that is dividing, and in this case was 12, right? It was not necessarily 12, it was like 10 plus 2, a bit more complicated than that. But 12, nevertheless.
Mm. And time zones and railway timetables. we don't think about these things. And I know I'm going to keep saying this, but really, you want to read this stuff, people, because it's fascinating. And you'll also discover that it all sort of connects back to cartography. Sometimes the connections are quite tenuous, but it always gets back to cartography. You had another post a couple of weeks ago called Portugal is Not a Small Country, which was a post about propaganda maps. And anybody who's a lover of maps and has sort of studied the subject at all will have delved into the thousands of propaganda maps that people have been making since, I think, the 13th, 14th century. There's some very early propaganda maps which just exaggerated the size of a dominion relative to its neighbours to illustrate its power. But this one about Portugal, I must admit that I had missed... I know the history of Portugal. We were in Portugal a couple of months ago and went round a museum and followed the history of the revolution and everything else, but I was still absolutely stunned by this. So tell us a bit about Portugal is Not a Small Country, Miguel.
So that's, from my point of view, one of the most iconic propaganda maps of the 20th century, right? And in order to describe to the people, probably you can check it later, right? But it's basically the map itself that created all this article is basically called Portugal is Not a Small Country, and it portrays Europe. And you can see the colonies of Portugal at the time. If I recall correctly, it was 1933, 1934, I believe. And then you have in a comparison of all the colonies of Portugal, superposed to the European continent. And you can see Mozambique and Angola mainly, but also you can see all the tiny places like Timor-Leste, Goa, and all the other tiny islands and places all around. And the point of the map was basically saying, oh, Portugal is not really a small country. We have all these colonies that if you put them together, it's actually to a comparable size to Europe. The fact of this propaganda map is that it works quite well in the sense that when you compare visually, they overlap and, they seem similar in a way, but definitely there's plenty of gaps. And it avoids talking about the obvious thing, which is most of these areas in Africa, in Mozambique and Angola, were not even populated, were not even being exploited by Portugal, right? They were like part of the dominion, part of the realm, but not really as equally industrialized as Europe was at the time. And the reason why I came up with the full article is, again, you need to understand which type of government come up with that type of propaganda, which in this case was Salazar, which was the dictator of Portugal at the time, and then provide a bit of the background on all the colonial history of Portugal, and then moving forward, a few other examples. But what I like the most, and that probably the linkage is what really was the purpose of the article, is with the last map that is... is another propaganda map that was created in Angola just 15 years ago. I believe it was 2010, 2011. And that is called Angola is Not a Small Country. which is taking literally the same idea that Portugal took for their propaganda map. It portrays Angola with a lot of Portugal maps just overlapping the Angola map, just to prove that Angola on size, it was 10 times Portugal, right? A bit more than 10 times Portugal.
Okay, so, and there's loads more. There's loads more. I'm guessing on Mappers Milhão, there's loads of propaganda maps.
There's a lot, and there's a reason for that. So I study geography and history, right, at the uni after I finished engineering, telecommunication engineering. Long after I finished, right? When I was studying history, it's true that I became quite obsessed with propaganda, and mainly because we were checking original sources, and then you realize, like, from really, really antiquity, right? Like there was the way that they were writing and they were portraying reality was kind of biased at all times, like today, and like it's been all across history. And then you realize that there's certain patterns and everything. And then, you know, that merge that came to be, which is that you realize that there's maps that are also propaganda, which is two of my main hobbies. And also, funny enough, I wrote a book in Spanish on propaganda that was published last year. And literally, I learned a lot more, right? That I could not really include images and anything in that book, but because of all the references that I was reading and discovering, I came up with so many propaganda maps. And the thing is, like, a regular map already has a story to tell, but any propaganda map, Jesus Christ, there's a lot to tell, right? Because that comes into perspective and this even design choices, right? The way that the cartographer chooses the right color, the right projection, or which numbers to display, which numbers not to display, and every other thing is quite fascinating, I would say.
And I think the thing that distinguishes propaganda maps from a lot of other propaganda is that if you write a pamphlet, everybody knows that what you're writing might or might not be true. But when you draw a map, everybody assumes that that map is correct because 99% of the people in the world have no idea how to draw a map. They also have no idea that it's possible to draw a deliberately misleading map. And so I think propaganda maps have a particularly powerful ability to miscommunicate to people.
And that's completely right. And not only, right? It was even, when you say pamphlets, right? Like, you know, the flying pamphlets that were quite popular, First World War, Second World War mainly. You were dropping pamphlets on people that were having difficulties to read, right? Not everybody was capable of reading properly. But kind of a map, it was a bit of like, oh, you're telling me that this is this thing and this is that thing and this thing is way larger or red, or, you know, like you completely interpret that way quicker than a thick test where you try to express the same amount of information.
So what's next for Miguel and A Cartographer's Tale?
So there's a lot of ideas, right? So, for example, taking the example of Portugal, and I don't know why I keep on getting back to Portugal, but they have really, really amazing propaganda maps, right? There's one story that I want to tell that I haven't even written, not in Spanish, and probably that might be the first one that I write that I clean English and then adapt into Spanish. But it's on the what is called, I believe in the name in English would be the Pink Map, which is at the time of the colonization of Africa. You had Portugal that had taken the east coast, which was Mozambique, and the west coast that was Angola. But the part in the middle, which is today's Zambia and Zimbabwe, was basically unexplored yet, right? But at the same time, the Brits, they did have all the way from Egypt, Sudan, Kenya, Tanzania, right? And also South Africa, or parts of South Africa, not also that's also slightly complicated, right? But again, there was a need for the British Empire to build the railway south to north, right, to connect all the colonies. But the same need was required by the Portuguese, right, to trace the railway, exactly, east to west. And the problem is that no one owned it and no one has explored it. And it's a difficult area to explore, right? It was all the Victoria Lakes and all that is around that area. So the way that the Portuguese started to do it at the end of the 19th century, around 1880, is started displaying a map all across. That was what called the pink map. That was basically putting Angola on the left, Mozambique on the right, and then I'm basically going to claim it on a map. And they started creating all the pink maps. It's called pink map because usually it was pink, the territory from Portugal. And it was kind of claiming before even exploring, which, by the way, is something that it's been done forever, right? You claim it on a map, and if someone believes it, they're not going to come to explore.
Yep, absolutely. And, you know, I've got some old English school atlases, and I think one of them goes back to, say, 1930s or 1940s. And when you look at the world maps in those, the British Empire was pink. I don't know why, but we choose pink as the color that we're going to use to claim territory. And if you look at the atlases over the last 90 years, you will see the amount of pink on the atlas gradually reducing until there isn't any.
And to be fair, and this is me speaking from memory, but I'm pretty sure that all the descriptive maps, world maps of the British Empire from the 19th century, they're all painted pink for the British territories.
Okay, so that's going to be one of your next posts, but you keep having to generate one every week. Oh, you've got a backlog. You've got a backlog in Spanish, so it's not...
But I have to keep up also with the backlog because I still write weekly in Spanish.
Okay.
I still have the will to do it weekly, and I still have the time to do it weekly, and that's the plan. So it's true that the worst part for a lot of people is coming up with the idea. Ideas I have... I literally can tell you that I have 80, 90, 100 ideas to write about, and I don't even explore that often because every week I just come up with this other idea that seems like way more relevant. And but there's quite a few things that I definitely want to write about.
So we can look forward to Cartographer's Tales for a couple of years at least.
Unless something terrible happens, which I hope is not the way.
Me too. So, Miguel, how can people get in touch with you?
So, definitely, I am available in Mastodon and Blue Sky, right. Also Substack. That I think that my website has an email in there. Right. Almost any. The handle that I have in most of the places is MapasMiod, and that handle I tend to read replies, comments, or anything. Right. Don't do it daily, I admit. But I'm, you know, that's detox from social media.
So I'll put those into the show notes at the end of the show notes.
Cool.
Miguel, it's been a pleasure talking with you this afternoon. I can't tell you how much I enjoy your posts. I'm looking forward to next week's post already. Everybody listening, give it a look. If you read one and you don't want to read more, tell me about it because I'll be surprised.
And you don't have to. Not mandatory, I promise.
Okay. Miguel, thank you very much. Take care.
Thanks to you and thank you, everyone.
Thanks for joining us today on the GeoMap Podcast. We hope you enjoyed the discussion. You can get the show notes over on the website, which is at thegeomob.com. And while you're there, you can sign up for our monthly newsletter and find links to our accounts on Mastodon and LinkedIn so that you can stay up to date on all our upcoming events. We hope to see you at an event soon.